Katie St. Clair had trouble with her weight from the time she was a young girl. When she was in her mid-30s, she was over 350 pounds, and like most of us, still pretty sensitive to what people would say about her. She heard it all.
Some guys have been like, you know, I just always really admired you. You're so confident and this positive, big, beautiful woman. I'm like, wow, thank you, you know.
Then there was the first time she met her boyfriend's father.
Well, I guess the dad said, is that your girlfriend or is that just your friend? And he's like, that's my girlfriend. And he's like, I can't believe you're going out with that.
Katie St. Clair says the fixation on her size made it harder for her to know what she was comfortable with, and she eventually chose weight loss surgery. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Doctors tell us that the increase in cases of obesity is one of the most troubling health issues of our time. One of every three adults in the U.S. is now obese. One consequence of this is an equally dramatic increase in the number of people who choose weight loss surgery. In 1995, 20,000 people had something like a gastric bypass done. By 2005, just 10 years later, the number of surgeries was up to over 170,000. Katie St. Clair knew she'd been getting big, but she'd very carefully avoided stepping on the scale. Around the time she was in her mid-30s, her doctor told her that it was time to face the number.
So, you know, she held my hand and we went over to the scale and I turned my back so I didn't watch it. Like, I wanted her to, like, unveil the number to me. I don't know how she was going to do it, like on a pillow or something. And she's like, okay, I don't think the scale's going to work. It doesn't go up high enough. And when she said that, I was just, like, shocked, you know, because I knew it went up to 350. Oh, my God. How am I was, that number was so mind-boggling to me that I could weigh more than 350 pounds. I'm like, how do I get out of bed in the morning? I mean, I should be one of those people washing themselves with a towel and a stick, you know, like, I don't know. So I didn't believe it. I thought maybe there's something wrong with the scale. And then I ended up going to the surgeon and they weighed me and it was 360, which was very sobering. And then, of course, I'm like, okay, I'm getting this freaking surgery.
Katie says she discovered there was comfort in food when she was a little girl. Life at home wasn't great. Her dad had a drinking problem, and she'd fight with her mom.
I don't know how I got it in my head that it was my parents' anniversary, because they never really paid attention to that kind of thing. But I had it in my head that I wanted to throw them an anniversary party. And we did what little kids would do. You know, we called all the parents on the street and said, we're having a party in 20 minutes. Come over. And, of course, all the parents were a little bit busy at the moment. So we couldn't get anybody to come. So it was just the two of us. So we said, well, okay, we'll just do it ourselves. You know, my parents were out somewhere. I was all alone, which is another good example of my upbringing, kindergarten and home alone with another friend. But we wanted to surprise them when they came back. So the only thing we could come up with to eat was cinnamon toast, which was the only thing I knew how to cook. So we made a ton of cinnamon toast, put it on a platter.
A ton would be how much?
Probably like half a loaf of bread.
Yeah. Okay. lots of butter, yeah. Lots of cinnamon.
Yeah, and then we cut it in little squares, you know. I'm sure they looked awful. I put it on a platter and I put it in the closet in my bedroom. And then we waited. And I could tell right away, you know, when you're a child of an alcoholic, you just have these really good senses for things. I could tell when they drove up that things were not going good for them on that day. And I started to feel really uncomfortable. And then they walked in and we jumped out and said, "Happy anniversary." And I don't remember precisely what my mother said, but it was something very derisive. You know, like, oh, shut up or quit it or go away or something just really painful. Yeah. And very embarrassing in front of my friend because my neighbor was just this perfect little creature. She was blonde. They went to church every Sunday. We used to have arguments, she and I, about whether or not God existed. And since we were so young, it was more like, does not, does too, does not, does too. So that was extra embarrassing in front of her. And
so did she stick around or did she leave?
No, she left. And how my family dealt with things is we would just go off in our separate areas of the house and just deal with it on our own. There was never any trying to work through anything or any interaction. So I went in my room and shut the door. And I guess I just thought I should eat the cinnamon toast. So I sat there and I ate. I don't know if I ate the entire thing, but I certainly overate and ate a lot. And I started to feel this numbness that was kind of pleasant. You know, like when you've had a really great cry and you just kind of feel like you've had a massage or something? It felt like that.
Sort of drained and, in a way, but drained in a good way, right?
Yeah, it's a different feeling than the bad feeling, you know? I mean, I think that's like drug addicts, you know? I mean, they might not be very happy, but it's a different feeling than the really bad feeling. So, and I think I was too young to go, wow, I can start using food to feel better. But I think I've probably felt a little guilt for overeating, and something clicked in me that made me think this was something I could start turning to.
You're listening to The Story. Katie St. Clair is a young woman who recently got weight loss surgery, and we're talking about how she got there. Katie says that as she got older, she kept having troubles with food and family.
We were watching soap operas and having a really nice time together, and my mom brought out a big platter of, I called it Midwestern antipasto. It would be like Triscuits, peanut butter, you know.
Cheddar cheese.
Cheddar cheese, stuff like that, and we were eating it and having a good time, and I decided I really wanted a grilled cheese sandwich, so I went in the kitchen and I made a grilled cheese sandwich and I brought it out and I was eating it happily, and I looked over, my mother has the worst looks sometimes, and she was just looking at me like with disgust. You know, her shoulders were drawn and she was just like, "You're such a glutton." And
no humor in it.
Absolutely not. I mean, she was just so, it was like I was what you would say when you found out your friend was a pedophile or something. That's how she imparted it to me. And actually, that's one of the few times in my life that my mother came and apologized. Hmm. And she stood at the door and she still had the same look on her face, but she's like, "I'm sorry." It was kind of like she was sorry that she had to say she was sorry in a way.
She was sorry that you were crying, not sorry that she'd said something to make you cry.
Yeah, I think she felt, well, I think my mother felt a lot of shame for having the antipasto Midwest platter, you know? I think that she had food issues and she probably overate that afternoon. And when she saw me take it one step further, I liken it to like you're at a Coke party and everybody's, you know, sniffing Coke, and then someone whips out the heroin and everybody turns them and goes, "Whoa, junkie," you know. So I think a lot of it was my mom's own food issues again.
Was there a time, Katie, when your own eating got out of control? Did that ever happen to you?
No. Food called to me all the time. It would call to me. And I could eat a quart of ice cream over an entire day for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to stuff myself to the point of being uncomfortable. It was more the craving for the food that was calling to me.
As Katie St. Clair got older, she discovered that family issues with food and weight and shape were actually part of what she'd inherited.
Well, my mother told me that she had been anorexic when she was in her 20s. Not to the point of being hospitalized, but, you know, I mean, I see pictures of her and she was very slim. So she kind of, and I think this is true for a lot of women, it gets passed down through generations. Your grandmother says, "Don't wear horizontal stripes. You look, you know, whatever." Actually, it's what, vertical stripes you're not supposed to wear.
I don't know.
My grandmother said that to me once, "Don't wear horizontal stripes. You should wear vertical stripes." Just, so my mom had that from her mom. And, so food was kind of this weird, the word commodity is coming to mind, like it had a lot of power. I know, like when my mother would have to make something for a school function, she would only make bars, you know, like 7-layer bars, so that we would be in the pan and we couldn't, like, it wasn't like cookies where we could eat them. So she would keep it in the pan and then we'd cut it right before we took them to school. And so, yeah, there's a lot of a forbidden nature about it. We never had any really goodies at our house. That's how I ended up inventing cinnamon toast, because where there's a will, there's a way, you know.
But did you have to clean your plate? For example, it was like not you can't leave the table till your plate is clean, or Katie, I caught you in the kitchen eating when you shouldn't have been eating, that sort of thing?
I would get chastised, yeah, for overeating and for stuff like that, but never. I always finished my plate. That was never really a problem. And I liked I liked all foods. I even liked spinach. The only thing I didn't like was liver. So mostly I just remember that you know, there's this taboo around bad food. My mother had this idea that I should start making my own lunch starting in, like, I guess, fifth grade. And so I would get up, and I would not be hungry. And being a little kid with a not fully formed brain, not realizing I probably would eventually get hungry, I'd be like, I'm not hungry, so I'm just not going to make lunch today. So I would go to school with no lunch. And I'd be starving by lunchtime. And there was a kid who never was at school, but he was on the lunch program. So I would pretend I was him, and I would eat the hot lunch, which was always really good stuff that I never got at home. Or I would just not eat lunch all day, and then I'd come home and be just so hungry. And I would pull myself up on the counters and eat whatever food we had, and then, you know, I'd have to eat dinner too. I'm sure that set up my metabolism for some gnarly stuff later. Put your body in starvation mode as a child is probably not a good idea.
Katie St. Clair had her share of ups and downs on her long way to weight loss surgery. She went through a stint with bulimia. She got strange advice from a therapist. But she had good times, too, like when her friend had her watching the door at Stinky's Peep Show.
Well, my friend Audra puts on interesting shows in San Francisco. And she set up this night every Thursday at a club where there'd be three, like, punk bands. And in between, there were large and lovely go-go dancers. And there would always be some theme. They would wear costumes and stuff. And they were all – you had to be at least a size 16. So I became part of that. You know, you dress kind of sexy and wear a lot of makeup, and chubby chasers would show up and stuff like that. And so that was really the beginning of me embracing not just the fact that I was fat, but that maybe I was kind of cute, you know?
I'll talk more with Katie St. Clair about gaining weight, worrying about it, not worrying about it, and then getting weight loss surgery. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Katie St. Clair had weight loss surgery about 2 years ago. She's talking with me about how she got to the point where she chose the gastric bypass and how she's felt about her decision since that time. Katie's not alone. The number of people who are opting for weight loss surgery has been increasing by the thousands every year for the past decade. Katie says the image she had of her body took shape in first grade.
They would do this thing where you have to lie down on a big piece of paper and your friend traces your body.
I remember that.
And then you draw yourself in or whatever. Uh-huh. And the teacher hung them up all around the room, and I was pudgy. Mine was just a little bit different than everybody else's, but it was awful. It was awful. I mean, the fact that I remember that, I'm sure that had some impact on that.
Isn't that something? I mean, I remember the act of lying down on the brown paper that had been cut off a roll and remember nothing after that. And the fact that you have memory of this sort of brown paper mirror hanging on the classroom wall like a specter.
Yeah, what if there was a child who was an amputee or something? How would they feel looking up there like, wait a minute, everybody has arms but me, you know? It was a little bit like that. I think that teachers are well-intentioned, and they try to, you know, make us – I don't know what they're doing with that exercise, but if you're different, a lot of those exercises just make you feel worse and not – they don't help you embrace yourself.
Katie says by the time she finished high school, she had that teenage fixation on body image. She moved out of the home and found that her desire to attract attention was foremost on her mind.
But I had no idea what to do with it. I was terrified. And I didn't trust that they really liked me, and I was insecure. And so that brought up a lot of stuff. And I remember eating like a scoop of ice cream one day, and, you know, that was forbidden food, and feeling really bad and kind of, I mean, everything that I learned about bulimia in after school specials or whatever just basically taught me how to do it. So I went in the bathroom and I threw up ice cream. And one thing I don't think people really talk about with bulimia is that it's a violent act.
And it hurts.
You tear up.
Yeah.
But it feels good when it's done. It gave me that same calming feeling, I suppose, that the cinnamon toast did when I was little.
Was it a feeling of accomplishment or a feeling that your body was saying to you, oh, feeling good down here?
You finally have beaten yourself down in a way that is satisfactory to you. Like, great, I hate myself, and I've just done this thing. Plus, I'm getting rid of the bad food. It's just a real sick mixture of a lot of different things.
What does hate yourself mean? Does that mean hate your body or hate your, or really hate yourself?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think that I hated my body because that was an easy target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you watch on Oprah the people that have body dysmorphic disorder where they hate their nose and they're obsessed with their nose, and if only their nose was different. And we view them as these interesting creatures. Oh, those poor things, you know, what's it like? They really hate your nose and you can't leave your house. And but there's women, millions of women that hate their bodies, and it's just sort of an accepted part of being a woman. I don't want to be in a bathing suit. No. But we transfer everything. I transferred everything to my body. If I didn't get a good grade, it was my body. If someone wasn't interested in me, it was my body. If I went to a party and it didn't seem like anyone wanted to talk to me, it was my body. It was a convenient place to hang everything.
And then it sort of becomes itself, right? Because you end up looking down, not looking up, you know?
Yeah. And I became my worst enemy, you know, when I became fat. I mean, I became the thing I was terrified of. But, you know, I think I had to go there. I had to, like, go to the belly of the beast, pun intended.
Did you have any luck with therapists?
My first therapist really messed me up. She had been bulimic and an alcoholic, and she fed my obsession. She fed my eating disorder.
How?
Well, I remember being at one of my lowest points in my life, just really depressed, and I finally, you know, got enough gumption to go to a therapist, and I sat down, and she's like, okay, you're depressed. And I said, yeah. It was nice to have somebody say that, you know, like voice that. She's like, we have to help you feel better. You need to lose weight. And I, you know, anybody else would be like,
oh,
red light, thank you. I was like, oh, you really get me. Yeah, I just need to lose weight. Will you please help me? Mind you, I was like 15 pounds overweight. So every week I would come in and she would weigh me. I remember I went on vacation to California and we had this big lead up, like, okay, you're not going to eat this and you're not going to eat that. And I came back and I weighed myself and I had gained a pound. And I was distraught, crying, and she was like rubbing my back. She's like, it's okay. It's not like you gained 5 pounds.
Which would be a tragedy.
Yeah, horrible tragedy.
You left this woman at some point, I hope.
I did leave. I really should have been commended for going on vacation and basically maintaining, you know.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Katie St. Clair struggled with her weight and her body image, she did get some good advice from a therapist.
She started seeing me, and she didn't freak out about my size. In fact, I would say something like, I'm really nervous about going on the airplane because I'm big. Going on the airplane when you're big is awful because you feel bad for the person who's squished next to you. And she would say something like, it's not you that's wrong, it's the seats that are wrong. Like, she just tried to, like,
take it off your shoulders.
She really believed this in her heart. She wasn't blowing smoke up my butt.
Yeah.
And so I started being able to be a little easier on myself and then work on the things that were underneath my body. I started being able to feel smart and being able to enjoy myself more and my friends and stuff like that. And she took away a lot of the obsession that I had about my body.
And Katie says she finally started to develop some confidence. She found there were men who liked really big women.
And I met a guy, and I fell in love, and he seemed to appreciate my pudginess. And I sort of allowed myself to embrace that a little bit, to say like, huh, okay, maybe I'm okay this way. Maybe this is the way God made me. And that's when I started getting really, really fat. And I don't have a lot of memories. I mean, I have memories of when it was happening, but I don't remember overeating. I do remember finally saying, All right, yeah, I'm going to have cream cheese on that bagel. I'm not going to have it dry, that kind of stuff.
But now we have you at something bigger than a size 14, right?
Yeah. I had to start shopping at plus-size stores, which was just like all of this stuff. I can't even really put into words how inconceivable all this was for me. I mean, imagine the people you see on TV that are full-fledged anorexics that are hospitalized, and they look in the mirror and they see somebody fat. Imagine if they woke up fat. And you know what? I needed to embrace myself at what I perceived to be the worst possible thing that could have happened to me, which was getting fat. I needed to embrace myself in that.
So what are you saying, Katie, that you became comfortable with you as a big person, that you didn't obsess about your size as you'd walk past a shop window or a mirror or something?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't fun being fat, but I began to be happier than I'd ever been in my life. It's like I keep thinking of Tammy Faye Baker's Run to the Roar. I mean, I ran to the roar, you know. I dove into the wreck. I got as fat as I possibly could, and then I said, okay, now I'm going to try and deal with this. The worst thing has happened, and I was surviving it.
Were you still and not then, weighing yourself at this point, Katie?
Never. In fact, I remember one time my therapist kind of nudged me, and she's like, well, what would a number like 250 mean? And I just shut down. I said, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about that.
But there was something going on with you, some kind of confidence, because you wound up at Stinky's Peep Show. What what was that?
Well, my friend Audra puts on interesting shows in San Francisco, and she set up this night every Thursday at a club where there'd be, you know, three like punk bands, and in between there were large and lovely go-go dancers, and there would always be some theme. They would wear costumes and stuff, and they were all, you had to be at least a size 16. So I became part of that. I was the door person, so I didn't actually have to like stand on a table and dance and stuff, but you know, you dress kind of sexy and wear a lot of makeup, and chubby chasers would show up and stuff like that. And so that was really the beginning of me embracing not just the fact that I was fat, but that maybe I was kind of cute, you know.
What are chubby chasers?
A chubby chaser is somebody who's attracted to bigger women.
And so were you being chased?
Yeah, I got a lot of action when I was there, and that was interesting too, because I mean, I was so closed off when I was, even when I was smaller, I was like kind of, you know, prude, because I was terrified of my body, I didn't want anybody to see me naked and stuff. So yeah, I was having a lot more fun when I was really big than when I was smaller, and it was a lot of the work I did with a therapist.
What were you wearing that was different?
I would wear a corset and a tight, like, pencil skirt, and, you know, you just show off your curves. Usually when you're a fat person, you're wearing, like, flowy, you know, this and hippie stuff, but it's a little kitschy what we were wearing.
But was it fun?
It was great. It was great.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Katie St. Clair says there was a time when she would have sneered at weight loss surgery, and that was a time when she was settling into her life as a big woman. Other aspects of her life started to feel comfortable as well.
My career was going really well. I had kind of a hip job. I was a music editor at a large weekly out here, and I really didn't hold myself back. I was living the life of an interesting thin person.
I don't understand what you mean. You were thin on the phone or what?
Well, yeah, I was thin on the phone. That's a good way to put it. I don't know. I guess I just always pictured – I was always waiting for things. Like, I'm not going to let that happen for me until I'm thin. But I didn't really wait for things. I went out and I got them. I guess if I really wanted them enough, I got them.
But was there guilt or hesitation involved? I mean, if you had set up an interview with some interesting band, would you try to do it over the phone instead of going down to the...
Yeah? Yeah, I was terrified. I started kind of developing a name for myself. I had a different column at that time. And, you know, I would get fan letters and stuff like that. And I did kind of want to keep it a secret that Katie St. Clair was fat. And I hated that about, even when I was a regular journalist, I hated showing up to interview people and you know, there are stereotypes about fat people, and I don't think I was taken as seriously, which sometimes is good when you're a journalist, because especially, this is going to sound sexist, but I kind of use that to my advantage of someone thinking I'm kind of stupid, because you can get a lot more information out of them. But yeah.
You mean people would react to you as a big person, that you were somehow not as smart as a thin person?
Well, who knows how much of this was my own fantasy, but it came up a lot, job interviews, stuff like that. I could tell, even trying to get an apartment, this one guy in Mill Valley, which is this really nice section of Marin where everybody's super healthy and rides bikes and eats apples and
Spandex
stuff.
Land.
Yeah. I went to look at this apartment and I loved it. And I could just tell he was just a little uncomfortable with me. And there were some stairs up to the apartment. He's like, "You sure you're going to be okay on the stairs? Will the stairs be a problem?" And I was just like, "What are you talking about?" Like, I would forget that I was fat, you know. That got really old. I mean, I think the saddest thing that happened when I was fat, I had a boyfriend, and we went to meet his family. And we drove up to where they live in this remote outpost in California. And they were kind of nice to me a little bit. Well, I guess the dad said, is that your girlfriend or is that just your friend? And he's like, "That's my girlfriend." And he's like, the dad said, "I can't believe you're going out with that." You know what? I was an amazing writer. I was funny. I mean, I was a warm, nice person. And they were too ignorant to get past my size. And so when I found out that they were so judgmental about my size, I was like, idiots, you know, or something. I don't know. I guess I kind of tried to turn it back on them. But that really hurt. That really hurt. So it's a series of tiny deaths is how I like to describe it.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Katie St. Clair said she had this part of her that was large and in charge, and this other part of her that was always conscious of her size.
I avoided going home for Christmas every year because going on the airplane was always so awful. And one year my dad was like, "Please come, I'll put you in first class, the seats are bigger," and I'll, you know, so he cashed in his frequent flyer miles and I got in first class and I was still pretty squished. And I was so nervous that I was going to have to ask for a seatbelt extension. And I asked the stewardess and she said, "Sure," and she went and got it. And I guess that the other stewardess heard too, so she, in the meantime, had grabbed one. So they both walked over with one in their hand. And so it looked like they were giving me two, like I was so fat that I would need two extensions.
Perfect.
And they both kind of like were chuckling about that.
It was soon after that when Katie went to see the doctor.
I had no idea how much I weighed. I thought probably that I weighed like 250. So I thought, wow, if I lose 100 pounds, I'll weigh 150. I'll be really slim. So that's when I started thinking about doing it.
You didn't even know how big you were at that point. Did the doctor make you get on the scales?
I had an amazing primary care doctor who I just love. And she's really the first person who brought up weight loss surgery to me. I also had my roommate was having it, but I always kind of thought that it wasn't for me. And then she brought it up. And she is also the person who gave me, I was terrified to weigh myself, absolutely terrified. And she's like, "We'll do it right here in the office. I'm here with you. It's just a number. You're going to be the same person you were before you got on the scale." So, you know, she held my hand and we went over to the scale and I turned my back so I didn't watch it. Like, I wanted her to like unveil the number to me. I don't know how she was going to do it, like on a pillow or something. And she's like, okay, I don't think the scale's going to work. It doesn't go up high enough. And when she said that, I was just like shocked, you know, because I knew it went up to 350. Oh my God. How am I was, that number was so mind-boggling to me that I could weigh more than 350 pounds. I'm like, how do I get out of bed in the morning? I mean, I should be one of those people washing themselves with a towel and a stick, you know, like, I don't know. Yeah, so I didn't believe it. I thought maybe there's something wrong with the scale. And then I ended up going to the surgeon and they weighed me and it was 360, which was very sobering. And then, of course, I'm like, okay, I'm getting this freaking surgery.
I'll talk with Katie St. Clair about how the surgery changed and didn't change her in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. 2 years ago, Katie St. Clair decided to opt for weight loss surgery. In making that choice, she would join hundreds of thousands of others who are having similar procedures done as a way to control their obesity. Katie had to choose what kind of surgery she wanted. She looked at gastric bypass surgery as an option that might be best for her.
Gastric bypass dramatically reduces the size of the stomach. With a smaller stomach, the patient is physically unable to eat large amounts of food. Gastric bypass also shortens the small intestine so that the body absorbs less of the food eaten.
Katie says that the decision to go ahead with the surgery was a mix of both mental and physical considerations.
I had talked to my doctor about wanting to get pregnant at some point. And was it safe when you're big? And she said, no, it's not. You know, there's gestational diabetes is a real risk. I wouldn't recommend it. And so that was in my mind.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, and not so much like it's not like I've thought, oh, I'm going to go get a boob job. But it was kind of like, I'm tired of being fat. I've worked on my insides and I want my outsides to match.
When the day of the surgery came, Katie St. Clair says she had no hesitation at all.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of remember waking up in a little bit of pain and being like, give me some Nemerol. Mm-hmm. And then I went in the hospital room, and then I had this nurse who was just, it was like her first week on the job. It was her, you know, her kids had grown up, and it was her dream to be a nurse. And so she was just, you know, loving her job, and I was loving her job, you know. And I felt, I mean, a lot of it probably was the drugs, but I felt like, there was no turning back, and I felt so good. I felt so good. I said, wow, what's next for me? So I was really happy.
When did you start to see the difference in your body shape?
I think probably really not until a year after, you know, when I really started to have a woman's body again with an hourglass figure. That's another weird thing. Like, when I was so caught up in anorexia and bulimia, I would get so excited about the slightest weight loss, you know. And the year that after my surgery, I was so divorced from that part of myself that had been obsessed with that stuff that I didn't really pay much attention to that. And that's kind of nice, I think. That's kind of nice. To me, I've just kind of woken up a size 16.
Were you checking yourself in the mirror on a daily, weekly basis to see,
Not really. I know every time I would lose weight and I would get, okay, wow, I'm wearing a size 20, you know. I'd be like, okay, I'm probably not going to lose any more weight. I still had that fear that I was going to be one of those people that it didn't work for. And then I'd be like, oh, gosh, okay, these are way too big. I guess I should get a size 18. And it's still amazing to me that I'm wearing a size 16. I could probably even be wearing a size 14.
So what's the high point now? What's your finest moment now?
I love being invited to things, getting dressed up and feeling good about the way I look and going. And I shut myself off a lot. I know it sounds like it was with the Stinky's Peep Show that I was really putting myself out there. But I started to get more and more depressed, and I started to retreat big time. And I think I was getting even bigger. So the fact that I go out to birthday parties or shows and stuff like that. That's, I'm taking part in life again. You know, I did really retreat a lot from life.
I want to ask you about guilt. What happens to guilt, though? Because if you were made to feel guilty for being too big, are you ever today made to feel guilty that you were so big you had to have surgery? You know what I mean?
Oh, God, I didn't want to be one of those people. Those people, you know. I saw myself in the same stereotypes that other people did. I haven't really fixed a lot of the root problems at all. In fact, all I did was clear away the cobwebs of the stuff that was there all the time. You know, maybe that weight was a convenient way to avoid a lot of things. Like when it comes to dating, I'm basically 13. I think I'm 15 now. After this last year, I think I've grown a couple years, but I'm still terrified of it and insecure, and I don't understand how that stuff works. And that's my next big thing I need to tackle at 39.
I don't get that. I listen to you talk about, you know, all these ups and downs that you've been through, and I listen to you laugh about it, and I don't hear a whole lot of insecurity in your story now. Are you just really good at masking
it? I'm insecure about dating. You know, like I said, when I got fat, I dove into the wreck there and I dealt with all that stuff. I haven't really had to deal with my insecurities about dating and being shy and that kind of stuff. I haven't really had to go there. That's my next journey.
Yeah, are you surprised that wasn't somehow repaired with the surgery at the same time? Did you have the hope or the expectation that would sort of take care of itself?
Yeah, I still have the eating disorder brain that if I look a certain way, then these things are just going to happen for me.
I wonder if people, Katie, say to you now that you're, what, size 14, 15, that, oh, you look so great. I hated to tell you, you know, X number of years ago how big you were, and now I can, as if you have friends who are, in a way, coming out about what they wouldn't say years ago. Does that happen?
No, in fact, it's been the opposite. Even some guys have been like, you know, I just always really admired you. You're so confident and this positive, big, beautiful woman. I'm like, wow, thank you, you know. I think I was the one who was discounting myself way more than anybody else was.
What's your favorite food, Katie?
Cheese.
And if you walk past a platter of cheese now, if there's one at a party, given the fact that you've had this gastric bypass, do you want to eat more than you can, or is that not a problem?
No, there's something amazing that has happened, and I do think it has to do with chemistry and hormones and things we just don't understand. I still enjoy food. I still crave food. I get hungry, but I don't have the urge to overeat ever, and it's a blessing. And it's possible that it'll come back. I'm scared of that because, I mean, I could eat all day long now. I could eat every hour. I think that's how people end up gaining weight back that have had the surgery, is that they just eat all day long.
Right.
But I also have a little bit of faith in all the work I did on myself. I did kind of work on the what's eating you stuff. So I'm not too worried about it. But I also give in to cravings, you know, and that's part of my liberation from the childhood of being told that food is bad.
Do you feel differently about yourself now?
I feel sad. That makes me feel sad that I spent so long not liking myself. And I feel like I wasted a lot of time. So I'm grieving for that. At the same time, I sort of see myself the way other people saw me, in the positive light. And I'm letting that in. So yeah, I'm still trying to find myself, but I'm not afraid to find out that person's pretty awesome.
Katie Katie St. Clair lives in San Francisco, where she writes a regular column for SF Weekly. She actually wrote a piece about her decision to have surgery, and we have a link to that on our website. In that, Katie includes her own before and after pictures, and you can see it all on our website at thestory.org. My favorite line from her article comes at the end, where she writes, "I still have anxiety, and food is still the first thing that enters my head whenever I feel it, but I recognize it, give it a little wave, and move on. I smoke and drink way more than I used to, which I'm sure is part of what they call a transfer of addictions that happens to many post-ops. So, yeah, I'm still a mess, but a better-looking mess." I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. It's been a while since I talked about not the story, but your story. Those are the moments in your life that leave an indelible memory. A chance meeting. A narrow escape. An unexpected discovery. Or what about those times when you've been on the computer and something you've been working on for hours or days goes poof. You might get it back. You might not. A few years ago, Bonnie Neville was conducting field research in the Danube Delta in Romania. She was living on a houseboat and working with what was then brand new technology, a GPS, and a laptop, which she took with her into the swamps.
It was basically attached to me. So if you can imagine, it was sort of like if you ever go to a ball game and there's a woman or a man there selling, hot dogs,
and they have
hamburgers,
the tray
and they
have that hangs in front of them.
Right. And So I had a tray like that that we'd rigged up, and the tray was strapped to the backpack, which therefore was strapped to me. And then the laptop would sit open on this tray, and we would literally kind of follow the blipping signal on the screen to the place that we needed to go.
Who were you working with?
I was working with 8 other Romanians. I was the only woman. I was probably 15 or so years younger than the youngest person there. And one of them spoke English pretty well.
How did they treat you?
At first, they treated me like I was a China doll, I couldn't carry a bag. I couldn't really do anything for myself. But they wouldn't let me lift a finger at first. I felt like an outsider.
You had one particularly bad day. Were you by yourself on this day? What was happening?
I think we were in a canoe at that point. And, we knew it was going to be a difficult place to get to. So we had our chest waders. And we get out of the canoe and we strap all the stuff on me. And then we follow my signal to find this one point. And it seemed like it was in the middle of this fairly extensive swamp. So my foot got caught on a submerged log, and I tripped, and I went in all the way. I just fell right into the water with my laptop. We just plunged down into the water.
Did you go slowly, as you sometimes will, or did you just go wham down in the water?
Well, in my mind, it went very slowly. One of those no.
There was nothing you could do. You're rolling in your back, and I can't.
I'm trying to, my reflexes are pull the laptop away from my body to keep it above the water. But, of course, I couldn't pull it out because it was attached to me. And so I went down, it went down. And then I tried to stand up as quickly as I could, as if it didn't happen. But it was completely submerged. I was completely submerged. I was drenched. The laptop was toast. And it was not possible to replace this computer, even if we had had the money.
How much data was in that computer, though, Bonnie?
It was the whole project, everything that we'd collected at that point. It was 100% underwater.
What are you thinking?
I was thinking, I just was sick. I felt sick. I was kind of numb. And so we kind of reconvened on the boat. And one of the guys said, why don't you just prop the computer up in the sun and see if it would try out the low-tech solution, I guess. So I didn't have any other solutions.
What else were you going to do?
Yeah,
sure,
exactly.
Why not?
So I opened it up like it was a book on this sunny deck. It was one of the few days that it was actually sunny there. And we just left it. And, got back, and of course it was completely dead. So the next day
You tried to start it. You pushed the on button.
Call me an optimist. And the next day we did the same thing. I left it out in the sun, like your laundry, my socks that I just washed. And that afternoon I came back so depressed. I was just so depressed. And I went to the computer, my little homage to the computer, and I pushed the button, and it went on.
It booted up.
It booted up. Don't ask me why. I certainly didn't deserve for it to be booted up, and I don't know how it could possibly have. I mean, I'm not an expert on electronics and circuitry, but that should not have happened.
The drives work? Your data
Everything
was all
worked.
There?
I couldn't believe it. It was almost the same stunned feeling that had been in my mind as I was going down in the swamp. And when it really, when the power went up and it started booting up and that noise, you know, it makes, I was just in absolute disbelief. Oh my God. It's actually working.
Did you call the others onto the deck?
Hey, it's working. You know, they were just amazed too. Everyone was amazed.
I wouldn't have believed it. I wouldn't have believed that it was all going to come back. Or if it booted up, I'd have had this fear that it would boot up, hiccup a couple of times, and then die. And that would be the end of it. You know, that would be my fear that, you know, maybe you're going to get this one flicker of light from it and then it'll be.
No. And it worked fine. And in fact, previously when I had been learning on it, it had had this really horrible, bad habit of freezing up every once in a while. You know, it did it pretty frequently. And after I dropped it in the water, it never froze up again.
It's like you improved its operations. And you went on with the project.
We went on with the project.
No more trouble with the laptop.
Nope.
Bonnie, this was 13 years ago. And you tell the story like it happened last week. Why is it so clear in your mind?
I remember so clearly that swamp and those trees, and it was fall, and it was kind of bare feeling. Because there have certainly been other times that I've done a stupid thing, and it just stayed a stupid thing that you can't, you didn't have like the secret escape valve to. This was, I got away with it, basically.
No
in my control. Right.
No
and it worked out. And it improved the computer.
Bonnie Neville lives here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This time last week, I was talking with the gospel singer Mary D. Williams. She was here to sing and to tell me that she's worried about the future of gospel music, how the kind of gospel music we hear on the radio today, that hip-hop gospel, doesn't really speak to people the way traditional music spoke to her grandmother.
And how a song would make all the difference. Oh, my God. I mean, she would just talk about how she could go into Hudson Belk and was just treated so terribly. And how that she just would hum, "It is well with my soul," or "Peace like a river." And the beauty of it is that real gospel, true gospel, it is just as powerful as it was then and is today.
After my conversation with Mary, Jacqueline wrote me from Harrisonburg, Virginia. She wrote, "I was listening as I prepared to go to campus to teach my class on African American history. Mary Williams' discussion about the state of gospel music really rang true for me. She expressed so well my unconscious response to hip-hop gospel and why I wasn't feeling it. As she talked about her father singing, 'I feel no ways tired after a rough day,' I could well remember my mother humming," she was no singer, "'His Eye is on the Sparrow,' and how hearing 'Amazing Grace' and 'I'll Fly Away' at funerals always makes me cry. When Mary talked about the power of true gospel music to heal and soothe, I listened to her sing the songs, nodded in recognition, and cried. Because my heart felt the power of that truth. Somehow the stresses I anticipated during my workday no longer weighed me down. Although I haven't been to worship in many years, her singing got to me, reminding me that I've been neglecting the needs of my spirit." The story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Rachel McCarthy and Rebecca Blatt sat in as producers this week. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowood. Jen Nathan's our audio editor. Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. Special thanks this week to our interns, because it's the end of the semester. They'll be leaving, and we're sorry to see them go. They are Greg Barbera, Todd Brantley, Julia Ritchie, and Nicholas Johnson. The story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.